G'day wherever you may be around the world, and thank you for joining us once again. It is time for Treasures from the Tanakh on Truth to You. That's truth2letteru.org. And don't forget to sign up for the weekly newsletter and keep up to date via iTunes, Facebook, and Twitter. I'm Jono, and joining me is Torah teacher Ira Michelson. G'day, Ira.
Chag Sameach, Jono.
Chag Sameach, my friend. And I'm a little bit different today because I'm not in the studio. I'm out in my sukkah.
Ah, that's really cool. I wish I could do that.
It's really nice. Well, I mean, you know, we're in different time zones, obviously, but at the time of this recording, we're in the middle of Sukkot, and it's a beautiful, and I also think it's the warmest day that we've had. We're coming into spring, and it's the warmest spring day so far, and it's just so beautiful to be outside today, and so I thought I can't resist. I'll bring the whole studio out into the sukkah, and so here I am.
That's awesome, and the perfect time, you know, to be outside and rejoicing.
Amen.
During Sukkot.
Amen. So you may hear, we may not hear a cat, but you may hear the dog. She's around here somewhere. There she is. Hello, doggy. Hello, little doggy. And sheep and goats and chickens and things like that. So we may have some interesting noises. We'll see how we go, but it's a beautiful day to be outside.
Amen.
Amen. Now, where are we up to, my friend? We're kicking off from Job 13, verse 20. And the reason why we kind of split it halfway through the chapter was because Job is answering, he's answering his critics, really. I mean, he's just spent the, I guess it's chapter 12 and the earlier part of 13 responding to Zophar. But here in verse 20, he turns things around and he addresses God instead. Is that right?
He does. And, you know, really what we need to do is we need to just go back one verse and look at verse 19, where he says, "Who is he that would contend with me? Because now I would be silenced and pass away," or the word there could be to expire, meaning gasping for breath, as in taking your last breath. So he's basically, talking about this idea of bringing the case again, and I think
legal,
we see that.
The legal proceedings, yeah.
Uh-huh. And so he's saying, basically, he's answering all of them, even though it's so far as the one that just spoke, and he's basically saying to them, do you think that the three of you are going to dissuade me from bringing this case? Because if I were to remain silent at this point, I would surely give up my last breath or expire.
So if I do understand you, are you saying that Job is conveying that his the only thing that's keeping him going is the hope that he can at least express himself to his friends, and the hope that he can vindicate himself to his friends?
Well, I think not. Actually, no. I think what we see is more of language that at this point he just wants to bring his case before Jehovah. And even if we go back even one verse further back, in verse 18, it says, "Hine na arachti mishpat yadati ki ani etzdak." Basically, he's saying is that see now I have prepared a case, a judgment, and I know that I will be justified. I will be made righteous, I will win. I will be vindicated.
That's what I've got. So see now I have prepared my case. I know that I shall be vindicated. Who is he who will contend with me if now I hold my tongue? I perish is what I've got. And so that's right. 18 and 19,
sure.
Verse 20. Only two things do not do to me, and this is where he's addressing God, then I will not hide myself from you. Withdraw your hand far from me, and let not the dread of you make me afraid. Then call, and I will answer. Or let me speak, and then you will respond to me. How many are my iniquities and sins? Make me know my transgressions and my sins. Now, this is we mentioned this before, didn't we, that he's still pleading, at least if I've done something wrong, how bad can it be? How many are my sins? You know, at least make me know my transgression and my sin, and then I can at least understand why it is that you're treating me in such a way. Is that fair?
Sure. And, he says, when he says, remove your hand from upon me, And then, you know, the Hebrew would actually read, and let not your terror cause me to be terrified. That idea of removing the hand, he's basically saying, remove your hand far away from me. Mm. You know, it's kind of reminds me of the, you know, in Fiddler on the Roof when they all come up and they ask the old rabbi, if there's a prayer for the Tsar, and he says, yeah, may God keep the Tsar far away from us.
This is may God bless the Tsar and keep the Tsar.
Yes.
Just far away from us.
And so in verse 22, when he says, and call and I will answer, or let me speak, then return to me. You know, it's kind of, you know, I'm just giving you the literal, and, you know, which really means reply to me. And this is similar to what we saw in chapter 9. In chapter 9, verse 34 and 35, I think it is, it says, let him take away his rod from upon me, and let not the dread of him terrify me. Then I will speak, and I will not fear him, for now it is not so with me. So we see in those two verses. So he's kind of repeating that. And we see that a lot. We see repetition here throughout. And I think we have to remember that while we're looking at Job as this great literary work and this great work of poetry, we have to keep reminding ourselves that that this is a guy who is just an intense pain and agony. I don't want to describe again because I know how little you like me describing.
It's pretty bad.
And we'll get to it. We'll get to it at some point.
It'll come back for sure.
It will definitely come up.
He goes into some description here. Why do you hide your face and regard me as your enemy? So, I mean, how about that? Job feels like God regards him as his enemy is what he's saying here.
Yes.
Will you frighten a leaf driven to and fro? And will you pursue dry stubble? That's what do you make of that?
Well, I think what he's saying is he's bringing up an argument that he's brought up before using different language. And the argument that he's bringing is, why do you waste your time with someone as puny as me? Why are you wasting your time with somebody, with man? And it's this idea of that loftiness of God. So on one hand, he wants to bring God down to his level and be able to, you know, try a case with him. On the other hand, he'll say, you know, you're so lofty that nobody can touch you and nobody can contend with you. Why do you even bother with the weak human that I am? And this is why I say we need to be reminded of this, because he kind of goes in and out of these arguments, and it seems to, you know, sometimes contradict what he says before. And that's why we have to remember that he's not going to be speaking as coherently as his friends, who are not suffering the way he is.
Fair enough. And so so he's saying, look, I'm but a dry leaf. I'm but stubble. Why are you toying with me like this? This actually, that reminds me of Fiddler on the Roof as well, because, you know, I remember Tevier is walking along and his horse has gone lame, and he's praying to God. And I love the way that he prays just conversationally and naturally speaking with God. And then he says, so you may have something against me, but what have you got against my horse? And then he says, you know, sometimes I wonder, you know, when things are quiet up there and you think, what mischief can I play on my friend Tevier, you know?
Yeah.
And but here is Job. You know, I'm just a leaf. I'm a dry leaf. I'm dry stubble. You write bitter things against me and make me inherit the iniquities of my youth. Are we to understand that Job in his youth, perhaps there's some might have been some issues there, and that now he feels like he's being punished for that? Or what? How do you understand that? Verse 26?
Well, you know, that could take us to some very interesting places, and I think we have to remember that you know, somebody being considered righteous doesn't necessarily, or somebody being considered right in the eyes of Yehovah doesn't necessarily mean that they are without sin or that they've never had sin. We see that with David HaMelech, with King David. You know, certainly there was sin in his life, and yet he was considered a man after God's own heart because of his heart, because he was after repentance. So this is very much what this reminds me of, and we've touched on this before, is Ezekiel 18. And Ezekiel 18 starts out with The Ivrim, the Hebrews, you know, arguing with God and saying that, you know, you're bringing all of this upon us because of, you know, our fathers, or you
bring our fathers have done, sure.
What our fathers have done, or, you know, these things in our past, you know, this is what you're bringing up now. And this is what Job is saying as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay, fair enough. And so he goes on to say, you put my feet in the stocks. That sounds very medieval to me. Is that what you've got?
Sure,
you put
yeah.
Feet in the stocks?
Yeah, actually.
Okay, interesting. So then, and that's an interesting sentence. You put my feet in the stocks. So it sort of suggests that there was some kind of punishment by which people's feet were put in stocks.
Well, I mean, you know, it's, hang on, I want to check a reference here.
You look up a reference, and I'll finish this first while you're checking.
Sure.
You put my feet in the stocks and watch closely all my paths. You set a limit for the soles of my feet. So we have path, we have feet, and we have feet in stocks.
Yeah, I actually like that word limit, and we're going to see that word quite a bit too. I'm just checking.
While you do that, I've also, Ira, I've got an asterisk here in verse 27, where it says, you set a limit for the soles of my feet. There's an asterisk, and it says, literally, inscribe a print.
So I wanted to look at the Halakh, you know, the Hebrew Aramaic lexicon of the Old Testament, which is, you know, probably, you know, usually the go-to for me on that word for stocks. And it basically says that they basically translate it as block or stake with cutout sockets and iron bars to secure the feet of prisoners.
Right.
So basically, yeah. So basically it's telling us that, you know, even in as far as they know, that we had this in biblical times as well.
That is fascinating to me, and I'll tell you why, and this is just getting off the topic a little bit, but I think if I remember correctly, the first time the concept of a prison is introduced is in the book of Bereshit, of course, with the story of Joseph. And we read that Pharaoh has a prison, and up until that point, there doesn't seem to be any such thing. Not to say that there wasn't such a thing, but that's the first time we're introduced to the concept. However, Job, being a potentially the oldest book of the Tanakh, we see here in verse 27 of chapter 13 that there was some sort of incarceration by which people's feet were placed in stocks as a punishment of crime. I just find that interesting.
That is very interesting.
Because there's, and the reason why is because we don't see prison in the Torah as a Torah commandment. We don't see stocks as a Torah commandment for punishment of a crime. So there's something to dwell on anyhow. There's something to dwell on.
Right. And we need to remember that we're talking about a time that was pre-Mitzrayim. We're talking in Ha'aretz, in the land. So we're talking about people of the East, remember. So we don't know what, just like the introduction of the execution by crucifixion. You know, that wasn't something, that was something that was introduced by the Romans. So certainly, you know, it's possible that this is, you know, I've never looked into it, but the legal language, a lot of the legal language that we see in the book of Iov comes from Mesopotamia. And I've done a little bit of study on the legal language of Mesopotamia, but I've never done study on their punishments. So it's possible that I might, I've looked at their law codes, but I've never looked at the punishments. So it may be something that I'm going to need to look into and see if maybe we come up with something related
to
that.
It's curious. We'd be interested in any comments from the listeners if they have anything to add there. But that's verse 27. And in verse 28, Ira, of course.
Well, you asked me about the setting a limit for the...
Oh, yeah. For the soles of the feet.
For the soles of the feet. And that word that really means to engrave or carve. What that could be is there's a reference to the fact that this was something that would have been done to slaves.
Fill me in.
That there was... that they might possibly have carved the names of their slaves into the slaves' feet.
Wee.
And so this is why the fact that it's connected with this idea of putting the feet in stocks and watching all of my paths. And you know, of course, we see you set a limit for the soles of my feet, but that word, tidchakeh, actually means to carve. And there's a reference to this, to the idea of that there was a carving in the foot soles of slaves.
Oh, boy. Now, we know, of course, that Job is covered in sores, that his skin is just covered in some kind of leprous boils or whatever it may be, and he actually says, from I think somewhere further back, wasn't it, he says from the top tip of his head to the sole of his feet that he's covered in these things, and perhaps it's another reference to the soles of his feet having opened up from the wounds that God has allowed to be inflicted upon him.
Yeah, it's very possible.
Yay. So there's another reference to the kind of gruesome state that he is in. But so too is verse 28.
Sure. Well, wait a second.
I don't want to dwell on it too much.
I'm not ready to move on yet. Because we're actually going to hear these words later again. In our study, from one who would appear to have been standing nearby. And we see this in Job chapter 33 when Elihu speaks, and he says this in verse 10 and 11. He says, "Behold, he invents pretexts against me. He counts me as his enemy. He puts my feet in the stocks. He watches all my paths." And so what we're seeing is, and of course this is going to be down the road for us when we get to it, but Elihu could have chosen anything to respond to, but he chose these two verses specifically. And remember earlier we discussed the paradox that we see in Job's responses, that on one hand, which I said before, on one hand he's making the argument that God is too lofty to even consider the plight of man, and yet now the enormity of claiming that he's considered an enemy of God. It would appear that this was it was so close to blasphemy again in their minds. Okay, I'm making that distinction because sometimes people, you know, get upset when we say poor Job is being blasphemous. But I think that it would appear that this was so close to blasphemy that Elihu just had to respond at that point. But in Job's defense, in the last verse, he sums up why it is that he brings his case. And you're not going to like this one.
Oh, I'm not. Verse 28, "He decays like a rotten thing, like a garment that is moth-eaten." And again, it's a picture of here's Job sitting in the ashes, sitting in the trash heap. Literally, his flesh is decaying upon him.
Right. He's saying, look, you know, all of this is going on while I'm decaying like a rotten thing.
Ooh.
A garment that's moth-eaten.
Oh, it's
his
gruesome,
skin's
isn't it?
It's got to be. It's hanging gruesome off of his body at this point.
Oh, it's gruesome. And this is the state that he's in. But now here we are knocking at the door of chapter 14. But of course, it doesn't change what Job is doing. He's still addressing God. He's still going on. And actually, Ira, this chapter 14, the beginning of chapter 14, holds some very familiar verses, some verses that a lot of people would have heard before. It begins like this: "Man who is born of woman is a few days and full of trouble." Where have we heard that? I mean, that's in a lot of eulogies, isn't it?
Yes.
Man who is born of woman is a few days,
right,
and so, full of trouble.
Sure. And so what he's doing is, and I like the, actually, in the Hebrew it says, "Man born of a woman is short of days and is full of agitation."
Agitation.
I like that, agitation.
Oh my goodness.
Sounds better than trouble.
It does. Full of agitation. He comes forth like a flower and fades away. He flees like a shadow and does not continue. And do you open your eyes on such a one and bring me to judgment with yourself?
Right. So what we're seeing is that idea of agitation speaks about restless motion, that you know, constantly you know, this restlessness and agitation, and he continues questioning God as to how man is a worthy adversary for him. And we have to remember that it was Sophar who spoke about this chasm that exists between God and man. He reminded, you know, Job that how could you even want to contend with God? You know, he brought up the loftiness of God.
Indeed. Who can bring it? Well, how's this for a verse? Is verse 4, "Who can bring a clean thing out of an unclean? No one."
Sure. So first we, just to go back for a second, in verse 3, we get this idea of the courtroom drama again, because it says, you know, indeed upon one like this, you open your eyes or you fix your gaze, is what it says. And will you come in judgment with me? Really what it means is, will you go to law with me? Basically, I was born of a woman and you expect that I can live an absolutely pure life. I think that's what he's saying as well. Which speaks to what he said earlier about, you know, bringing up the iniquities of his youth. Who can make the clean out of the unclean? No one. It's true. If you decide his days, the number of his months is with you, his statute or limit. This is why I said I love that word limit, because it actually means statute here. His statute you have made so that you cannot pass over it. So he says two things. He says there's no way that anybody can make themselves clean. It's possible. And what you've done is you've set up a statute in the same way that there's a statute that Yehovah made with heaven and earth, in the same way that he made a statute with the sun and the moon, in the same way that he made a statute with the sea and the land, where the sea can't pass its boundary. And there's this perfection in the creation. He's basically saying that you've made a statute against me. You decide all of man's days, the number of his months, and you set a statute.
I'm just fixed on verse 4, of course.
Sure.
In the tradition that I come from, Ira, years ago, for so many years, we were taught that that you can bring a clean thing out of an unclean, and it was a huge part of the theology of the tradition that I came from. That's of course in many aspects, including of course what you digest, what you consume, is now clean. Though it was once unclean, it's now been made clean, and you can eat that stuff now. But it's not the case.
Oh, you mean the old? Yeah. Well, I mean, look.
I just like, so the way the Jeff says it.
I'm laughing because I remember something funny. Somebody once came up to me and they said, you know, I was having such a struggle the other day. I was walking by this Chinese restaurant and gosh, the shrimp were just calling to me. You know, I have such a hard time giving up shrimp, and the shrimp are calling to me. And I didn't say anything. I let it go. And then later on, a couple of hours later, the same person walked over to me and they said, you know, I was looking at a couple of verses and I wonder, you know, when we read the verse of the New Testament that Yeshua cast the demons into the pigs.
Into the swine.
And the swine, you know, went off the cliff into the water. You know, I wonder what happened to those demons. I said, well, the demons obviously went into the shrimp, and that's why they were calling you from the Chinese restaurant. So, and I had to say it because it sounded so nonsensical to me. But this is the idea. This is the idea of that, you know, this idea that things can be made clean. You know, I can remember, you know, having this discussion and this argument with people so many times. And I can tell you every single verse that they're going to bring to make the argument. And
And I think most of our listeners are way past that. We certainly are, I suppose. But it certainly takes me back, because I just like the way that Job says it. Who can bring a clean thing out of an unclean? No one.
Lo echad.
Lo echad. No one. Lo echad. Look away from him, he says to God. Look away from him that he may rest till, like a hired man, he finishes his day. Of course, he's talking about his life, as if he's God refers to him as a servant, his servant. Have you considered my servant Job? He says to Hasatan, and Job feels like, you know, has my service come to an end? Can it please just come an end? Can you look away from me until my job is finished, and I pass? My life is gone.
Right. And so there's a couple of verses. These verses really need to be seen together, because he says, cease or refrain from gazing upon him until he fulfills his day like a hired man, like you said. because if you consider man, or you consider me to be your enemy, which he's already brought up, he's basically saying, isn't the fact that you've made the statute that you've shortened his days and set up a boundary for his life. Isn't that enough punishment for him?
Mm.
Because soon enough, you know, he's going to tire and he's going to long for the time that he has fulfilled his days. And then as we move on from here, then in the next verses, Job then starts to make the distinction between the frailty of man and those things that are able to live past extinction. And he starts making these metaphors about trees and mountains and rocks and so forth related to man's life.
Mm-hmm. I've just popped into my head the conversation, the short and interesting conversation between Jacob and Pharaoh in Bereshit.
Yeah, I don't believe it's in 40.
Oh, here we go. So it's in, no, it's 47. 47 verse 9. Well, let me start from 7. Then Joseph brought in his father Jacob and set him before Pharaoh, and Jacob blessed Pharaoh. And Pharaoh said to Jacob, "How old are you?" And Jacob said to Pharaoh, and this is interesting because it's not, you know, he doesn't just say, "Oh, you know, I'm 100 and such," he says, "The days of my years of my pilgrimage are 130 years. Few and evil have been the days of the years of my life, and they have not attained to the days and years of the life of my fathers in the days of their pilgrimage." And so Jacob blessed Pharaoh and went out from before. But it just reminded me because he says, "Few and evil have been the days of the years of my life." Few and evil. It just reminded me of this verse here where it says that man who is born of woman is a few days and full of, as you say, agitation. Jacob refers to them as evil.
Sure. Yeah, where he says, Vidaim, you know, which of course I love the English translations when they try to what we call soften the translation, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Even the JPS has few and hard have been the years of my life. But it says, Me'at Vidaim Hayu Yemei Shnei Chayai, as you said, few and evil have been the years of my life.
Mm, just reminded me of that. But Job goes on. So verse 7, "For there is hope for a tree if it is cut down, that it will sprout again, and that its tender shoots will not cease. Though its root may grow old in the earth and the stump may die in the ground, yet at the scent of water it will bud and bring forth branches like a plant." Like a plant, what is plant? So, but man dies and is laid away. Indeed, he breathes his last. And where is he? Where is he, Ira?
Sure.
As waters disappear from the sea.
Where is he?
Where is he? And as a river becomes part, now we've already, so he's already, this is the second time he's used this analogy, like a river that becomes parched and dries up. So man lies down and does not rise till the heavens are no more. They will not awake nor be aroused from their sleep.
So in the first three, in 7 through 9, it could be a reference because where it says, Ki yesh la'etz tikva im yikaret ve'od yichalif, and this word v'yino kato could actually mean until you cause it to change or to sprout again. In other words, for there is hope for a tree that is cut down till you cause it to change or sprout again and its shoots will not cease. Mm-hmm. There could be a couple of references, different types of references that we could see here. And this could actually be a reference to death not being final, in the sense that those shoots that are being talked about are offspring that carry on one's life. This idea of causing it to change and sprout again and its shoots will not cease, because that word for shoots there could actually mean offspring as well.
Okay.
And then in verse 10,
that would make sense. Yeah.
And then in verse 10, it seems kind of a strange choice of words and a strange order, because, you know, reading it in the English from a Hebrew perspective, it says, "And man will die and he is weakened." What? Man
really?
Gasps. Yeah. Man gasps for breath or expires. Where is he? So it kind of seems reverse. I mean, a man doesn't weaken after death. He weakens before death. But this has to be seen in contrast with the metaphor of the tree, which seems to have the ability to die and come back, whereas man cannot. Mm-hmm. And so this is what he's doing. He's kind of contrasting the difference between this idea of the tree that can come back and man who can't.
Now, when you read these verses, you begin to wonder, is he contradicting the concept that so many of us are familiar with, the concept of a resurrection? Because we're looking at the tree and we might be able to see in there the concept of a resurrection, or in fact, as you've said, the succession of descendants continuing on.
Sure.
But when you get to man, what I've got is but man dies and he's laid away. Indeed, he breathes his last. And where is he? As water. And then the analogy continues so that we can try and understand what he's saying. As waters disappear from the sea, the river becomes parched and dries up, so a man lies down and does not rise till the heavens are no more. They will not awake nor be aroused from their sleep. It really sounds, reading up to that point, that it's over and out. You serve your time, so to speak, your few days that are full of agitation, full of trouble, days that are evil, then you die.
Well, yeah, and I think it seems like that, but again, he goes in and out of these different arguments. And we saw this. We saw very similar language in chapter 7, verse 9. Where this time he says, a cloud is finished and it is gone, so the one who descends to Sheol does not ascend again. In other words, when a cloud is finished, it disappears completely, so the one who dies does not come back. And we have two different metaphors here. You know, the cloud disappears, but here man sleeps and will arise.
So there is a hint of hope.
So there is
he actually
hint.
Goes on. He goes on and he asks the question. He says, that you would hide me in the grave, that you would conceal me until your wrath is past. Isn't that interesting? Well, how do we make that? To conceal me in the grave, hide me in the grave, would suggest that his body is dead, and he says, conceal me until your wrath is past.
Right. So if we look at this in context, you know, between the last two verses, I mean, this really speaks of the frailty of life in general. Who of us has not had thoughts about what they would like to accomplish? I mean,
sure.
You know, look, you know, my father passed away just about 3 months ago. And I remember speaking to him, you know, probably about a week or two before he passed away. Mm-hmm. And he wasn't ready to die. But I don't know anybody who's ever ready to die. And I don't know anybody who I've talked to in all the years of talking to people, you know, going to see them and visiting them when, you know, people are near death. I've never met anybody that didn't say to me, look, I feel like I have more to accomplish. like they have more work to be done. And I think this is what Job is lamenting here. And he even alludes to it in this next verse in 13 that you just read. Because I read it like this, who places me in Sheol to hide me, conceal me until your anger returns or passes. You would set me again. And this is where we see that, that word chok, which is statute. You would set for me a chok, a statute, and remember me. So he's sort of saying, if you would just place me in Sheol temporarily, that I might have a respite. And then when your anger passes, then you can allow me to arise.
And so that, but we're definitely talking about him passing away. We're talking about him dying. To be placed in Sheol is to be dead. And yet here is the glimmer of hope, right? He's saying, then when your anger passes, bring me back. Because he says, as you mentioned, and this is the way that it says it in English in my New King James, it says that you would appoint me a set time and remember me. And I've got an exclamation mark at the end of that there. And I know obviously it's not in the Hebrew, but they've chosen to put an exclamation mark that you would appoint me a set time and remember me. Verse 14, if a man dies, shall he live again? All the days of my hard service. There it is, referencing again back to his till like a hired man that he finishes his day in verse 6, that he says, all the days of my hard service, I will wait until my change comes. That's got to be a glimmer of hope, right,
Ira? Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he's basically at the point where he longs to confront God, to bring his case against him, but he knows that the only possible way he can do that is when he dies. He knows, I think that's what he's saying. And the truth is that nobody really wants to die because of the finality of death. If only death were not final, then I would wish to die. And so I think we're seeing a little bit of back and forth that I talked about. Depending on how you look at it, you can see him kind of being contradictory. You know, somehow you see a glimmer of hope. But what I think he's trying to say is, look, there's no way that I'm going to live again in the physical body that the only way that, you know, that perhaps I'm going to be able to bring my case before God is if I die.
So you don't think that he's suggesting that that there's a period of that he's going to die, there's going to be a period of time, and then there's a resurrection?
Well, you don't think he's
saying, may your wrath pass from me until and once your wrath is passed, then resurrect me, like the shoots from the dry stump, resurrect me, and may we be back on speaking terms. May we be good with each other. May your wrath have passed by then. Is that?
Well, I mean, look, he says, if a man dies, will he live? All the days of my service, I will wait until my change comes. Well, what
until
is this
change?
Yeah, what is this change that he's talking about? It doesn't, you know, I don't know that we can necessarily read into that.
It doesn't seem like the change is Sheol, because he says, hide me in Sheol until your wrath has passed.
Right.
And then after Sheol, it seems to me, in the way that I read it, that there is a quote-unquote change.
Right, but I believe that he's talking about when he stands before Yehovah.
Okay.
Okay, so that's just my perspective. I think, remember, this could be seen so many different ways when we look at Job. It's just not, you know, it's not possible in certain verses because of the, you know, antiquity of the Hebrew to always make perfect sense of what he's saying. So we do the best we can do, and certainly I'm just giving you my perspective on it from where I see him coming in these verses. I think later on we might see him be a little bit more clear about it. I just think we're not seeing it so clear in these.
And it's interesting because that the concept of a resurrection in the Tanakh, surely the verses are few and far between, right?
Yes.
And this would be one of them that certainly carries certain suggestions that you can build upon. But you're right, it doesn't give away very much. And it seems like there is just that we assume knowledge here, that there's just knowledge that everyone would have had. It was not something that they elaborated on, that they spoke about, that they wrote down so much. But there seems to be an understanding that perhaps we've lost today that they had back then. So it's interesting to tease out, and we will certainly get a chance to do that as we continue in Job. But he says in verse 15, you shall call and I will answer you. You shall desire the work of your hands. For now you number my steps, but do not watch over my sin. My transgression is sealed up in a bag, and you quote. Now, how about this? This is what it says, Ira, and I want you to elaborate. This is verse 17. My transgression is sealed up in a bag, and you cover my iniquity.
Uh-huh.
What is it in the Hebrew?
Okay, so this is interesting. It's the Hebrew there is vatitpol. And so when he says, you wrap my transgressions in a bundle, you watch every step, I would translate it as this. You wrap my transgressions in a bundle, you watch my every step, just waiting for the time to punish me.
Really?
Yeah, that's how I would. And the reason I say that is because basically this idea of do not watch over my sin really has the connotation that you have no patience for my sin.
Right.
And that's the context of the beginning of the chapter when he brings up this idea of, you know, the iniquity of his youth. So I think that we have to, you know, take it in the full context here. And the idea of that Hebrew titpol actually means to smear or to whitewash.
To whitewash. Now that's what I thought. That's what I thought. To plaster over or to whitewash.
Right.
My transgression is sealed up in a bag, and you whitewash or you plaster over my iniquity. I mean, the word is not Kippur. Obviously, last week,
yeah,
the Day of Atonement.
Yeah, it's definitely not. It definitely doesn't have the connotation that people would think in this idea of, you know, an atonement kind of thing. You know, because
let me just tease this out, because verse 16, for now you number my steps, but do not watch over my sin. Just to remind me again, how did you interpret that?
When now you count my steps, you do not watch over my sin. But I said that that we could look at it in this idea of that he has no patience for sin. You wrap my transgressions in a bundle. You watch my every step, just waiting for the time to punish me.
Waiting for the time to punish me.
Yeah, in other words, if I went to Sheol, if I died, then I could stand before you and present my case. But in this world, I'll never have the chance to plead my case, basically.
Is it possible that verse 17 is reiterating verse 23 of chapter 13? Verse 23 says, how many are my iniquities and sins? Make me know my transgression and my sin. And really what he's saying is complaining, because he's saying, you are punishing me for something that I've done, but I don't know what it is, and you refuse to tell me. Right. You refuse to tell me what it is. Perhaps he's saying, you've taken my transgressions and sealed them in a bag, and you cover my iniquity, and I don't know what it is.
Right. And so it's not this. And so, yeah. And so what the listeners need to understand is that when they read this, it's not God covering over his iniquity or, you know, atoning his iniquity. But what he's basically saying is that you're attributing all of this to me. You're whitewashing me with my iniquity. You're covering or smearing iniquity upon me.
And it's beyond him. He doesn't know what they are, and
right,
God doesn't
seem
to tell him what these are. Because you're not telling me. Perhaps that kind of makes sense to me, verse 17. We'd be interested in listeners' comments there. And 18, but as a mountain falls and crumbles away, and as a rock is moved from its place, as water wears away stones, and as a torrent wash away the soil from the earth, so we're talking about erosion, so you destroy the hopes of man. So his hopes are eroded from him. God has eroded away the hopes of Job. Well, you prevail forever against him, and he passes on. You change his countenance and send him away.
So in those verses in 18 and 19, it's that it's just bringing a different metaphor, but kind of saying the same thing. Because he returns to the idea that, like the trees that might sprout again, there's no injury to a mountain that crumbles or rocks that are beaten and return to dust, because they, like the tree, can produce life from soil that they produce.
Sure.
And
sure.
However, so he's bringing this idea of the hopelessness, of man, right?
Yeah, yeah. So though such monumental erosion may take place, it's not beyond bringing forth life again, and yet. It may certainly seem dire at the time, and it certainly does to Job, that you prevail forever against him. Forever, he says, against him, and he passes on. You change his countenance and send him away. His sons come to honor, and he does not know it. They are brought low, and he does not perceive it. Hey, what do you make of that?
Well, I just think he's talking about the hopelessness that there is, with all of these metaphors that he brings, that look, all of these things, they can still bring forth life. There's no way in the hopelessness of man that when you set this limit against him, you set this chok, this statute against him, and you overpower him forever, for all time, and he departs. It actually says his face changes or his appearance changes, and you send him away. So this idea of, remember that we talked about that, there could be this idea of shoots, that the tree could go down in the dust and it could bring forth shoots again. And the idea of offspring, that maybe there is no finality in death, but he's saying, look, even in my case, my sons could achieve honor and I would not know it. They could become brought low, and man just wouldn't understand it. Only upon his flesh is pain, and upon his soul he mourns.
And that is the last verse of chapter 14, and I'll just read it from my translation. But his flesh will be in pain over it, and his soul will mourn over it. And so it brings us back really at the end of Job's two chapters after he replies to Zophar and then addresses the latter half of it to God. But he brings us back to the dust heap. He brings us back to the rubbish dump that he is in, and the pain that he is suffering.
Right, and he really ends with this idea of the finality of death, and the hopelessness that he has in not being able to bring his case before God. Where it gets really interesting is when we move on from here, when we get into chapters 15 and 16.
Round two.
Because we get round two. And we have Eliphaz, who was very compassionate in his first response to Eov,
Out of the three friends, he was the most gently.
He was, and that's going to change quite dramatically when we move forward in the next two chapters.
So that's chapter 15. We're going to get into that next week. But we've been speaking to Torah teacher Ira Michelson on Treasures from the Tanakh. And before we disappear, Ira, tell everybody about the Facebook page.
Yeah, so we have a Facebook page up now that's Treasures from the Tanakh. So you could go to our Facebook page. We'll have the teachings from here that Jono puts up, but there's some other teachings that I do with Jeff Gilbert that'll be up as well, doing the weekly Torah portion.
That's with Jeff Gilbert and Rod.
And Rod Bryant.
Yes, and that's on Hebrew Nation Radio?
It is on Hebrew Nation Radio, but it'll be up on, the links will be up on Treasures from the Tanakh. And so if you'd like to interact with us, we encourage you to come, like the page, ask questions, make comments. Do that as well on Truth to You. When Jono puts it up, we love hearing the comments, listening to what you guys have to say and answering any questions you have.
We certainly do. We appreciate the listeners' comments and questions. And so Treasures from the Tanakh is the Facebook page of Ira Michelson. You can go there, like the page, get involved. And there's a couple of other programs that Ira is involved in there as well that you can listen to. So, my friend, thank you once again for coming on to Treasures from the Tanakh on truthtoyou.org. It's been a pleasure talking to you on such a beautiful day outside in my sukkah.
It is. It's great. I may have to go out and take a look at mine now.
I think you should. And until next week, dear listeners, be blessed, be set apart by the truth of our Father's word. Shalom.